This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Stefan Hostetter, and I'm here in studio with a full studio today. It's such a pleasure when I get to do this.
No empty chairs, Stefan.
Exactly. Normally we just keep an empty chair to the side just in case, but today we had to even use that one.
In case Trump shows up.
Exactly. Of course, this is Darren Kaster. And also, please, Trump, if you hear this, come to our show. That would really help with our ratings. The radio doesn't actually have ratings, but still, it would really help with our ratings. This is The Green Majority, of course, on CUT 89.5. On any of our wonderful radio syndicates across the country and a couple in the United States. So Trump might be hearing this because Trump is the kind of guy who listens to community radio. Or on Rabble.ca, because again, Trump's favorite news station is Rabble.ca. So thank you everyone for joining us. This is obviously a little more, I have a little pep in my step today, in part because on the way here, I was biking up from where I work, and there was this woman just sort of crouched down near the side of the road, and I was wondering what she was doing. So I looked over, and she was just writing "Have a wonderful day" in chalk beside the road. And I was like, "That is the nicest thing. You know, that's just a nice thing to do. There's no other reason to do it, just to like wish the world randomly a wonderful day. So have a wonderful day, everyone, from the wonderful woman on Beverly Street who wrote it in chalk. Also in the studio with me is Sabina and Deirdre. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to start the show with our top story, which I don't say enough, but I like saying our top story today is going to be really about old conservatism versus new. And I think the whole show might have a theme of sort of old ideas versus new. So we'll start with this one. And Sabina, you've looked into sort of Brad Wall got some heat and then Donald Trump made a speech. So tell us more about that.
Of course. So in this week's news, a group of environmental activists are calling out Premier Brad Wall to clarify his stance on climate change. And this is due to the fact that he referred to climate change as, quote unquote, a misguided dogma, which has also urged more than 1,000 people to sign an online petition criticizing him for his comments. Environmental activist Mark Biglin Pritchard has commented saying that he is out of touch with reality, to be quite honest. Moving forward, last week, Wall also criticized the new Democrat MLA, Kathy Spruill, for supporting the LEAP manifesto, which is a policy calling for Canada to move away from fossil fuels. As always, it comes back to the economic gains for a lot of Republicans or conservatives, where Wall states that over 3,000 Saskatchewan families have lost their jobs in the resource sector, which is why he wants to bring it back or wants to deny climate change. And however, this does not take into account for all the clean energy jobs that can come in the future in Saskatchewan if the premier decides to move towards a cleaner energy future. So moving forward to another climate denier in this week's news, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, I can't believe I'm saying that, unveiled an America First energy plan. He said he would unleash unfettered production of oil, coal, natural gas, and other energy resources to push the United States forward to energy independence. I don't even know what that means. His speech went beyond energy and targeted, of course, opponent Hillary Clinton, saying that she's declaring war on the American worker. First of all, I don't know when Trump has ever been defined as an American worker and he suddenly can like start to identify with them. I don't know. And he said some great quotes, and then Stefan is going to say some other quotes. He stated, "Free up the coal and bring back thousands of coal jobs."
Yeah, thank you. Two-part news story. Talk about that, and I'll talk about new conservative leader in Ontario, Patrick Brown. But first, just because I love all of three of these quotes from executive director of the Sierra Club about Trump's speech, all are great. The first is, this is speech yesterday, and then just thinking about Trump, I was sort of following it live stream, and reading the Twitter reaction to Trump's speech yesterday was hilarious. One person basically just thought he was reading the speech for the first time and then live reacting to it, as if they'd just given it to him, and he was like reading it, and was like, oh, this is what's happening? Okay. Because what's interesting about this is while of course it's been Trumpified to some extent, it's nothing different from what you've seen for the last 20, 30 years of Republican thinking. It's this idea of and what's amazing about this is that while the idea of energy independence is something that Republicans have trumpeted for so long, they completely ignore the fact that the Obama administration, the Obama administration actually has done and has actually seen a massive increase in production, energy production within the United States. Of course, they won't give them that, and of course, the way they're doing that is quite controversial with lefties. But it's a fascinating thing that they're sort of ignoring this piece. But the my three favorite quotes from Executive Director of Sierra Club on Trump's speech was one: I have never heard more contradiction in 1 hour than I heard in this speech. True, there are pools of oil industry wastewater that are deeper than Trump's grasp of energy. So that's a solid one. And three, a jumbled collection. He called the speech a jumbled collection of oil industry talking points that are devoid from reality and the marketplace. And that's the part what I wanted to jump in on. Because this idea that the Republicans and conservatives in general sort of put themselves forward as like, we're business people who understand business and government should be run in this sort of way. And then to have them sort of come with this plan, which is then so obviously like, the idea that you can bring coal back in the United States coal didn't die really because of climate regulations. The states does not have very strong climate regulations now. Sure, there are a couple things coming through EPA, but even those haven't really come into effect. Coal is dying because natural gas is a cheaper, more efficient energy, and it's being wiped out for that manner. So the idea you can bring coal back in the United States isn't even it's not a business. No one's starting a business to do this. Yes, Darren.
It almost sounds like you're implying he doesn't know what he's doing, Stephen.
It is almost like implying that, isn't it? And speaking of people who do know what they're doing, and who might have thoughts on this matter as well, a really interesting article was out on The Guardian, I kind of like the actual headline. I paraphrased it in my notes, but I want to say the actual headline as well, because it references philosophy, which is that oil firms have 10 years to change their strategy or to face a short, brutish end. Which is from Terry McAllister, the energy editor for The Guardian, and he's just referencing actually Paul Stevens, who's a Chatham House think tank fellow, who's arguing that basically major oil companies have 10 years to diversify or die. And what's interesting about here is like here's someone who's spending his time researching energy, and is looking at sort of at what we're sort of seeing with the drop in oil prices and stuff like that, and sort of coming to this conclusion that the prognosis is that the prognosis for IOCs, which stands for International Oil Companies, was already grim before governments became serious about climate change and the oil price collapsed. Their old business model is dying. And I think this is sort of echoing a bunch of other things you're hearing, and it's echoing what you sort of saw about 10 years ago with the coal industry. And of course, Evan will be like, well, what about electric cars? Like cars, everyone needs oil for all these sort of things, which is the classic talking point here. But I think the fact that we're like even ignoring the climate regulations, which you know, barring a Trump presidency, we'll see a consistent move towards that sort of reduction. We're still not seeing this move towards that. But what's interesting is that does exist in some pockets of conservatism. And Patrick Brown, the Ontario new PC leader, is, I think, really trying to rebrand the PCs as someone you might be able to trust with the future of the world. Of course, that looks like he gets to say one sentence saying he supported sensible carbon pricing. And that's as much as we're going to get from him. But like, I think this is an interesting scene to see finally seeing conservatives move towards that sort of way. And of course, Bob Inglis from the United States was a senator who basically lost his seat in a primary because he said that we should do something about climate change and lost to a Tea Partier. And he sort of started this really interesting thing called Republic N, which you can check, which is probably environmentalist basically. He's the only one, I think, still. But it's an interesting Twitter feed to follow if you want to follow that. But that's what we're seeing. We're seeing this transition from I think maybe, hopefully, in conservative thought that perhaps this other type of thought is possible. But of course, the other question is, what else do we do? And Deirdre, you covered another story today, this week, which is sort of one of the other things. Like, there's so many different types of renewable technology coming out, and each it's almost hard to keep up. And this is another one that's being sold in the Bay of Fundy. Tell us about that.
Yes, the newest in the world of renewable energy in Canada is tidal power, and it's finally coming to the Bay of Fundy. It's interesting that it's taken so long, given that we're surrounded by so much water, but. It is coming. Actually, it came in 2009, but it failed. The second installation is coming to the Bay.
Sorry, Deirdre, if yes. I can just jump in, that's a really, really important point, and that was the only thing I wanted to say on that story was the idea that the turbine, the forces in the Bay of Fundy are so strong that they tore their test one to pieces.
It
just shredded it. Oh, but yeah, but tidal power, there's no future tidal power. It just owned the test turbine we put in, and we had to build a bigger, stronger one because there's too much power.
Yeah.
But there's no future in time.
There's no future in renewables. Let's just get that straight.
Mother Nature's badass.
So badass. So the first one is coming in actually the next few weeks. It's getting on a boat in the first week of June. It's going to travel around Nova Scotia until it reaches the test site, which is run by the Fundy Ocean Research Center for Energy off of Parsborough, Nova Scotia. And it is hoped to generate enough energy, around two megawatts of energy, to power 1,000 homes, which is, significant for a country of 36 million. And this thing is going to be monstrous. It's going to be five stories high. It weighs apparently 1,000 tons, and there's another one coming as well. So the next one is coming through BlackRock Tidal. The first one is through Cape Sharp Tidal. So it's run through two companies, both through the Fundy Ocean Research Center for Energy, or FORCE, which is bringing in different companies to test in their facilities. The second one is set to head out in 2017, and it's going to be 2.5 megawatts, which is a little, it seems like a little more power, but it's run actually off 40 smaller turbines instead of one big turbine. So we'll see how that fares in the test facility. But it's supposed to be easier for maintenance. That's why they did smaller turbines versus the bigger turbines. But anyway, it's big couple of years for tidal energy, which is really exciting.
Tidal energy is always one that I find so fascinating because it seems to make so much sense.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's one of those things I would love to dig into at one point to really understand what's really holding it back. Mm-hmm. And if it's being held back just because the tidal waves are so strong that it's crushing our turbines, that's Darren pointed out, it's a quite ironic problem to have.
Too much power.
Exactly. what's interesting is that here are all of these, and I think that's the often you get from the environmental movement when you hear the sort of pushback, like, we, what about coal? It's like, sure, coal's a thing, but we have like these massive turbines that can harness the tidal power now. I understand that you want to still keep burning rocks, but there's something cooler we could be doing, and maybe we should invest in that. Like that's for me the number one reaction I always have against carbon capture and storage, is that it's always used as this example of this like cool new technology we could have. And I'm like, there are like, it's sure, it's cool and interesting if you pull it off, but there's also really other cool things.
It's like Captain Planet in real life.
Exactly. Just like Captain Planet. The great thing about Captain Planet was that he was always way too powerful for any bomb they ever had. He was the
including
kind of
oil.
Exactly. Yeah.
It kind of set us up for a false sense of
exactly.
A false sense of power there as youngins.
Yeah. Where's Captain Planet? Also, it's because we don't have the love ring or whatever the third one, fifth one was.
Heart.
There we go. But Sabina, you want to jump in?
No, I just wanted to make a comment on the carbon capture and storage. It's the main reason why people really like it and say it's a new, exciting technology. It's not new. It's like 25 years old or 30 years old, and it's been around for a really long time. It's just nobody ever decided to put it in all of the different facilities because it was going to be a little bit more expensive. But the main reason why a lot of people like it is that they don't have to change the way that they're doing things now, it's a lot cheaper, and they can just say, oh, well, why don't we just add a couple of scrubbers and, you know, we'll capture the carbon or most of it. So that's why all of these other ones, because even looking here at, for tidal power, they say that, you know, even though it does give us a lot of green energy and renewable energy, it's really expensive up at first. So it's like a lot of people have to put in that investment, or else they're not going to get any new technologies.
Well, that's something that's always really frustrated me, Sabina, because, like, you know, I think I don't have the number in front of me because I just thought of this now. So this is off the top of my head. But somewhere in the billions of dollars have been collected by the Alberta government under their carbon tax, which got redirected back to oil companies to work on carbon capture and storage, on CCS technology. If we'd just taken $5 billion and built $5 billion worth of wind turbines, the problem would be solved already. We don't need it. Like, it's the most stupidly, frustratingly desperate plea, which brings me back to Brad Wall. I do have a couple comments about that, but I'll stop for now. I'll get my shot in.
Well, one thing to note is that they haven't actually released the cost of this machine, but they know that around $33 million in contracts have been awarded. So it is providing work to people, mm-hmm. which is awesome. And also what's interesting is that I looked into what a megawatt is and how much power it produces, but it really depends on the type of energy it produces. So solar is actually kind of inefficient in that it takes more megawatts to power more homes. So I think that's another reason people are still all about the carbon energy, because it's a little more efficient than solar. But tidal, I don't know. I'd be interested to know about how efficient that is.
Cool. Thanks. So Darren, we have about 3 or 4 minutes left before we get into the break. So you have some thoughts on Brad Wall.
Yeah, well, let me shotgun the three main ones. First one was actually all the way back to Trump, which was, I want to make a point that I'm certainly not the first person to say it, but I think it needs to be said frequently enough that we keep it in mind when mm-hmm. anyone is discussing Donald Trump, which is that if you've been paying even the slightest cursory attention to his entire campaign, he doesn't mean a word of anything that he says. Anything. He doesn't mean a word of it, right? He'll come out on day one. And the thing is, it's very obvious what his strategy is if you're actually paying attention. What his strategy is was he understands one very basic fact as a marketer, which is the most critical thing to understand, which is that in politics, especially when you're talking about a low information right-wing voter, once you say something they like, they stop listening. So all he's been doing his entire campaign has been to go to a group of people, tell them something they're going to like, get them to cheer him and make him sound really cool. And he tells you, hey, I'm with you guys. And then he goes to the next town hall and says something completely different. He's currently on energy producers because he's making his way systematically through a bunch of sectors that he needs support from. And he's currently saying a bunch of stuff about how he's going to bring coal and all this stuff. He hasn't looked through any of it. I wouldn't expect him to care about climate change, so that doesn't shock me. But I would not take any certainty of his position on any topic whatsoever. This is entirely – now, does that mean I don't think he's going to do it? Totally. I actually think that if he was to win, he has no interest. He's a marketer. He likes being in the center of attention. He has no interest in being an actual CEO. In fact, he said that if he was elected president, he wouldn't even consider himself the COO, much less the CEO. He just wants the attention, right? So in reality, if we had a Trump presidency, the Republican establishment would be the people actually making these political decisions. He has no interest in actual governance. Now, that's terrifying because they're monsters. So we should still be afraid. I'm not telling people not to be afraid, but keep in mind that nothing he says has any connection to any actual intention. He contradicts himself twice in the same sentence on multiple occasions, much less the fact that he's full of it. So just keep that in mind. Very, very quickly on Brad Wall as well. I don't see him as the same sort of person. I think something we have to keep in mind, I really want to get I'm blanking on his name, but our guest that came in on the show and was actually from Saskatchewan,
I wasn't there.
Co-host. He's going to be listening right now. He's going to be so mad at me. I'm sorry. Somebody who came in and was contributing with the show, and we're going to have him back in. He's actually from Saskatchewan, and he has a lot of information that he was
going to share.
If
you're a man from Saskatchewan and can walk to CIUT, we need
right
to
now,
talk to you.
I'm just being hideous and blanking on somebody's name right now. I apologize. But anyway, the point being is that I don't think we're looking at the same thing. I think Brad Wall probably is not an evil person. Mm. I think probably what the situation is, my honest assessment of it is that he has publicly gotten behind a certain position and a certain tone. And when you make a complete stand on an issue and extremely publicly, especially as a politician, it is virtually impossible to walk it back, especially when it's the main crux and all of your voters agree with it. It doesn't matter how many times. The thing is, he can't. It's not that he won't concede that he's made an error. He can't concede that he's made an error because it would not only – he would be just let go from – like he would be gone. He would never work in politics again. And they would guarantee that the Conservatives lose the next three elections in Saskatchewan. So yes, he's doing horrible things and he's saying incredibly stupid stuff, but I don't think there's any point in arguing with him because he will never concede because he can't concede. And I don't think that's because I think he probably does know he's wrong. It's impossible for him to admit it. So I just think that we should keep that in mind and let go of any attempt of trying to bully him into changing his position. Mm-hmm. We need to go around him or we need to get rid of him. He's locked himself into a corner he can't walk out of. It's a waste of time to talk mm-hmm. to him.
You have the name.
Yeah, Clark Barr.
Thank you, Clark. We love you if you're listening, Clark.
And I think that lets me sort of wrap up the segment in a way. Thank you, Darren, for bringing it back to Brad Wall, because I think that's the one thing I wanted to sort of highlight to some extent in this piece is that Brad Wall, I think, is an old stock Canadian. I know. I think Brad Wall. Thank you, Darren. I almost got a spit take out of Darren. Brad Wall is kind of. I think he does deeply care about the people, but he's just he just isn't in touch with what's happening now. I think Donald Trump is just the Joker and just isn't a part of reality. Or is like playing
the Joker from the Batman films, where right. on the way out of the heist, he shoots all his co-conspirators so that he's the only one that takes the money.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Like new Joker,
new
not
Joker,
old Joker,
new Joker. And then I think Patrick Brown is the theoretical face of new conservatism, which I think is equally is concerning in different ways, but at least is like taking reality as it is, which is nice. And welcome back to the Green Majority. That I appreciate a song that really demands its title be known. Yeah, it's like I feel like there's a level of respectability there. But welcome back to the Green Majority on 89.5 CIUT FM, or any one of our wonderful radio syndicates across Canada or in the States, of course, rabble.ca or on our podcast greenmajority.ca to find that. And today we are now once again in studio again, full studio. In the first section, I did not introduce our last chair. So I'll go introduce everyone again. Of course, thank you, Sabina Hyseni, Deirdre Leonita, Darren Kaster, and now Barbara Gratulova from the Canadian Environmental Law Association is here to talk about the cap and trade program that just got instituted or just got passed, I think, a week or two ago in Ontario. But first, explain what the Canadian Environmental Law Association is.
Thanks, Stefan, and thanks for having me. So I'm the articling student at the Canadian Environmental Law Association. And for those of you who are not in the legal profession, articling means lawyer in training. We just have funny words for things. The Canadian Environmental Law Association is a legal aid clinic that focuses on environmental law. So our mandate is to work with low-income individuals, community groups, nonprofit organizations, and we work on issues of environmental law and environmental justice, issues of law reform and advancing environmental justice concerns using the legal tools in Ontario.
Amazing. Well, thank you for joining us. And of course, you guys released a couple months ago, a briefing note on the law and a whole report on the law.
Yes.
Called Fair and Equitable Carbon Pricing, Comments on Ontario's Cap and Trade Program. So if I can ask you to sort of summarize those comments. What's your, again, cap and trade is, of course, is constantly, to put us into a larger context, cap and trade is consistently considered one of the two main ways to have carbon pricing. When people say price on carbon is the holy grail of carbon reducing policy, mm-hmm. it's cap and trade or carbon tax usually. The two that are referred to, there's a whole bunch of other ones, but those are the two main ones. And so the Ontario side of cap and trade, and you guys sort of actually went through what they were proposing, and what do you see?
Do you mean just in general what the proposal is right now?
Yeah, and then we'll get into sort of CELA's response to that.
Sure. So so Ontario decided that they're going to go with cap and trade, and this is following more than a year now, I think, of public consultations and going through different rounds of different options. And they finally settled on cap and trade bill, and the proposal came out in February, if I remember correctly. This has been multiple sections to this. So Bill 172, the Climate Change Mitigation and Low Carbon Economy Act, that just got passed last week, as you mentioned, establishes cap and trade program in Ontario. And so the main features of a cap and trade program, as opposed to a carbon tax, is that it would set a hard cap on carbon emissions across the economy. So the Ontario cap and trade doesn't actually cover all of the emissions in Ontario, and they rarely do, just because a lot of emitters are way too small to be captured under this. But so the Ontario cap and trade program captures about 85% of Ontario's emissions, which is pretty great, and it sets a hard cap across the economy on how much carbon dioxide equivalent can be released per year, and then that cap decreases by just over 4% per year. And so the idea is that the participants of the cap and trade program, which is large emitters over 25,000 tons, as well as electricity importers, natural gas distributors, and petroleum suppliers, the participants to this program have to essentially give up an allowance for every ton of carbon dioxide equivalent that they emit. That's where the trade comes in, because one of the things you can do is trade allowances with other emitters who have reduced their emissions more effectively than you did, or for whom it's cheaper. So the basic feature of this is that there's the four ways that emitters can receive an allowance is you can purchase it from the government, which is how government is generating revenue in this program. You can trade with other emitters, as I mentioned. There's also free allowances that the government is giving out to certain emitters just to kind of ease them into this program. And then there's a smaller percentage of allowances can be met through offsets or early reduction credits. And this is how the rest of the emissions, those 15% of the economy, can fall under the plan.
Amazing. What's interesting about this is it's usually considered the more free market approach to putting a price on carbon. The idea, of course, is you just make carbon releasing a no longer unlimited resource, and you price it. It's a way to price externalities, which is something that, of course, we say probably every show. I'd love if you go back and listen to every one of these shows and tell you, so if we've said price externalities on every show, I'd be really impressed with us. But of course, and there's criticisms of both a carbon tax and a cap and trade, but both of them have one similar concern, which obviously Sheila highlights in your brief, which is sort of the regressive effects of carbon pricing, or what could be regressive effects of carbon pricing. Can you sort of explain that to me?
Sure. So, and we are a legal aid clinic, so obviously our interest is in how this affects low-income and vulnerable communities, and I think this is an interest that the environmental community as a large should care about when we look at this from the perspective of climate justice, right? So low-income communities are already disproportionately more affected by climate change to begin with, and they're more disproportionately affected by carbon pricing, which tends to raise the price of fuel, of electricity, of these kinds of daily products that, frankly, low-income people have a harder time changing their habits, or maybe if they're renting an apartment, they don't have control over their over how their energy is being used. So we've been advocating throughout this consultation process for certain measures that would make this program kind of take that into account and ease the transition for low-income people. And there's actually there have been some interesting gains if you look at the proposal as it was first put forward in February and then as it stands right now. So the other features of the program that I didn't mention is the greenhouse gas reduction account, which is what they call the fund where all the money will be put into. So that will then be the government will then use money from the greenhouse gas reduction account to fund projects that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the things that's a very positive change is that the minister, in determining which programs to fund, has to also look at whether the program will help low-income individuals in achieving greenhouse gas reductions or mitigating some of the impact of carbon pricing.
Amazing. So there's two other quick things I want to cover. The first one is this idea of the vulnerable community's low potential to reduce emissions. Before I get to that, I want to jump back to a news story we've been trying to cover for the last 2 weeks, which is the leaked document about the $7 billion that the Ontario government is going to put into fighting climate change. Because first of all, $7 billion is a huge number and is all like is a impressive step for any government to make. But what I found interesting is sort of when I was reading your Sheila's brief and then comparing it to the money that's being put out. When you look at the money, where the money is going, you know, $3.8 billion of the money of this leaked document claimed that the money will end up going to new grants, rebates, and other subsidies to retrofit buildings, move them off natural gas to geothermal or solar or other forms of electric heat. That's actually a very progressive attempt to get rid of natural gas, which is not considered a low-hanging fruit more often than not. But at the same time, as you mentioned, isn't necessarily going to help low-income families, because what are the chances low-income families owns their own house or can afford to get sort of rebate on retrofitting when they don't actually own the space? And you see sort of that when you go through some of the other things, you know, new building code rules, we're called our homes and small buildings to be built in 2030 or later to be heated without using fossil fuels or natural gas. Same sort of thing, right? You know, these people aren't reducing that either. There's electric vehicle incentives. But again, electric vehicle, how many people actually buy new vehicles? You know, there's a very specific subset of people who actually can afford to buy new vehicles. So any sort of incentive to buy electric vehicles is great, but that's still only affecting people who are buying new vehicles, right. and you go through all of them. You know, arguably, you get down to some of the later ones. You get some ones that are actually a little more in line with, you know, bringing people up. For example, $200 million to build more cycling infrastructure, $354 million to the GO regional rail network, and there's $280 million to help school buses buy electric buses. That one's a sort of just a random one, but I like it, so I'm mentioning it. But then again, you know, another $1.2 billion goes to factories and other industrial businesses to cut emissions. And so clearly, what's interesting about this is all of this really feels framed in trying to reduce the most emissions, which is important, but not so much of a thought seems to be going into the sort of helping these lower-income communities come back. So I'm interested if there's any sort of things that Sheila recommends the government to do specifically to help low-income communities, or if it's more of just a general ask.
Well, I wanted to touch back on a couple of things that you said there. And going from the end of what you said, it seems that a lot of the way that these investments are judged is based on how much emission reduction can we get right now per dollar invested. And in some ways, that may not be the best strategy, because you end up investing into the low-hanging fruit, like you mentioned, and not investing into more long-term, you know, larger capital investments that won't pay off until later on down the line. And what we could end up with is, okay, great. Well, we invested a lot of money into this low-hanging fruit. And what do we do now? Now we need a lot more dollars per greenhouse gas reduction. So that's one thing, that efficiency may not always be the best metric. And with regards to the specifically investments for low-income individuals, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak to the leaked document. I haven't looked through it, and I mean, it would be interesting to see the final version once it actually comes out. There was an announcement actually yesterday, I believe, where Ontario government is investing $900 million over 4 years into retrofitting social housing apartments specifically. That's $500 million of it, and then $400 million into rebates and investment for rental apartments for energy efficiency projects. So I think we need more of targeted investment like that, like social housing investments. And there have been a lot of, this is one example of a pretty substantial investment that would be very beneficial. So it's good. It's important to recognize that. With regards to natural gas, that can get a little bit tricky. It's not, I mean, natural gas is a fossil fuel, but if you're looking at it from the perspective of low income, you know, remote northern communities, for example, it's still a lot efficient than electricity in some ways, and the electricity grid really is only green as green as the energy that goes into it, right? So there's a lot of concerns there, and I think we should be focusing more on conservation, but for people who, you know, need heating right now, natural gas may end up being the more efficient fuel compared to you know, using oil, for example, or right. or different kind of sources. So it's not as clear cut as, okay, this is a carbon fuel, so we need to get rid of it. There's got to be more that goes into thinking through this and thinking the cost for right. low-income communities.
You're saying that complexity exists? This is unacceptable on the show, Barbara.
I'm sorry to burst your bubble.
Sound bite. Darren, you want to jump in with the question?
I have a sound bite.
Oh, you have a sound bite.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, really fast. One, I don't make a... Premier Wynne does not always make it easy to be a fan of hers. She's a very complicated character. And I mean that genuinely as I said it. Sometimes I'm a huge fan, sometimes not so much. You know, she makes it difficult to be a complete cheerleader for her sometimes. But I think I want to cut her some slack here on one thing, which is that, you know, we do just remind everybody part of the issue we have of why we point out frequently on the show, but why it's so difficult to get some of this stuff passed. She does have to deal with an election cycle. Mm-hmm. And I think by throwing gobs of money at a bunch of low-hanging fruit, I think what her strategy is, because they have been threatened by other parties, regardless of what the vote says, they've been, you know, pretty threatened by other parties several, you know, elections in a row. And I think what her goal is, considering there was a couple of scandals earlier, you know, valid or not, earlier in her career, definitely a couple moves that peeved off her base with regard to selling infrastructure and stuff like this, that she needs a couple of wins that can be demonstrated to be wins on this front before they go to the next election. And I think if I want to cut her some slack, the plan is get this stuff in, get it generating benefits that people see and like, so they can go, yeah, we want more of this. And then at the beginning of a next assignment, she can try and find some money for some of this other stuff. I think that's actually politically savvy, whether or not I think that it's environmentally the best thing to do. Mm. And on the other thing, just really, really quickly, at the end of the article here from the Globe and Mail about the leaked document with regards to low income, there's a bit from the energy minister, Mr. Shirelli, acknowledged that there had been a debate about the cabinet meeting. I'm now quoting from the article, but said it ended with 100% consensus on the climate plan. And he said, quote, "We have a normal amount of debate on the issue. If you were to leak every cabinet meeting, you'd find out, you know, that there's a good amount of airing of points on views on all issues." And then asked if Mr. Murray, who was in charge of the plan, had to change or water down the plan to get the cabinet to buy in. He apparently cracked a grin and said, "You know what? I'd be breaking my oath if I told you that. You know that." Which you should read as yes.
Of course, yes.
So my assessment is that that's who got screwed in that compromise, was the low-income stuff. That's just a guess. I have no evidence, but that's my assumption.
Well, and just to go back to complexity, right? There's a lot that goes into it. And if you look at carbon pricing, it affects so many aspects of our economy, and so many people will be affected. It's hard to pinpoint exactly what changes needed to be made to the plan to get it passed.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about that is I think the difference between the fight between an environment and energy minister actually is a really interesting one, specifically on this issue, because of the fact that the number one case against most environment initiatives is that it raises the cost of energy. So as an energy minister who wants to keep who wants to keep energy prices as low as possible, again, which would obviously have benefit everyone, including low income individuals, it's an interesting fight to be having over this particular thing, right? But I want to get one more question in before we go to the break, because I think it's the last piece of, I think it's perhaps in my mind the number one piece that differentiates carbon tax from cap and trade, which is this idea of some people get free allowances, because you know, carbon tax is really just a tax and you walk away with it. It's usually pitched as a really simple solution, or literally at least an easier way to walk away from. Whereas this one has so many all these little pieces, and whenever a carbon cap and trade program has collapsed or has got issues, it's when there are too many of these free allowances hanging around. You guys obviously have the part of that in your briefing. So tell us a little more about what these free allowances do.
So the free allowances, an allowance is something that every emitter needs to give up for every ton of carbon emissions that they produce. So when they get a free allowance, it's essentially like a subsidy, right? They would otherwise have to pay for that allowance or reduce their emissions by that amount. And so the government looks at which industries in Ontario are energy intensive and trade exposed, which kind of puts them at a what they call a higher risk of leakage. So the idea is that if you charge them too much, they'll move somewhere else and there will be no greenhouse gas reductions because they'll just pollute in a different jurisdiction. I think this is becoming less of a concern as more and more jurisdictions actually do implement carbon pricing. But I mean, our position is that way too many free allowances have been allocated. So, I mean, they haven't been actually allocated, but they, you know, emitters have to apply for that. But looking at the regulations, it seems like there's a lot that's going to go to industry. I mean, if you look at carbon tax, I don't know that much about the Alberta plan, but my understanding is that the Alberta carbon tax also has, you know, different provisions for different. Yeah. So it's, I mean, everything could be implemented in a way that's simple and in a way that's more complex. This is just something where we'll have to. We now have carbon pricing, which is amazing. This is a really great win for Ontario, and we'll just have to keep watching and making sure that we do get the carbon reductions that we should be getting, and that it's being done in a sustainable way. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Barbara Gakalova. I want to give you one last chance to sort of any last thoughts you might want to cover on this topic, or alternatively, just let us know where, if someone is interested in CELA and the work that you all do over there, where they can find more about you.
I'm going to do the latter because on our website, CELA.ca, which is CELA.ca, you can read all the reports that we've written on this issue, of which there are many, which would be a lot better than last thoughts. But yeah, it's an exciting new thing for Ontario, and we just got to keep watching and see how it develops.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Barbara. And welcome back to The Green Majority. We let you listen to the whole song that time here on CAT 89.5, which is a rare one, but we were digging it, and then we got in a whole conversation actually about other cap-and-trade stuff, which from Sabina, which we'll actually save for the bonus show. So check out the bonus show on greenmajority.ca for that. Thank again for listening and for rabble.ca's support and all of the wonderful radio syndicates of The Green Majority. We love you all and hope you're all having a wonderful day. But we still have 10 minutes left of this show, and Darren, we've been talking about feisty weedies a couple times off air, so I'll bring that back up on air. Darren has some feisty weedies about Exxon and their shareholder. So, Darren, lead us in that news story.
I just want to say first that's the first time in my entire life I've ever made a thing. So thank you, Stefan.
Well, feisty weedies is it.
Yeah. That's. I'm going to go it on a high note. So it's really funny. So, I mean, it's not strange. We've had over the last several years a lot of a lot of stories of people, you know, doing very showy, trying to get in as journalists and then sort of either being in as journalists and like, you know, leaking stuff that makes people look bad at shareholder meetings and annual general meetings, AGMs for major corporations. We had an interesting thing, I think it was 2 years ago now, I'm just going from memory, sorry, of a guy that went in and it was a really funny story, Stefan. I don't know if you remember this one. It was a guy that went in, I don't remember what company it was. I think it might have been a coal. And he went into an auction. It was a public auction.
Or he bought.
And he placed like a $10 million auction bid on a tract of land and successfully kept it from the coal company. So they jailed him for making a fake bid. But because of the rules, they couldn't actually take his bid out. So they could get him in trouble for not being able to pay the bid that he made. But he still successfully prevented, because of the rules, successfully, it still had to stand. So he still, at least temporarily, successfully prevented this coal company from buying the land mm-hmm. that he was going to then coal. So he essentially traded the coal development for a jail sentence, which, you know, big up for him.
Yeah.
But there's stuff like this, right? And so there's it's not new to have people go into places, and I'm of mixed feelings on this. I think in some places it's incredibly valid and incredibly legitimate, and in fact is something I would encourage in certain situations. In other situations, I think it's either badly done or not, you know, legitimately not appropriate, or sometimes taken out on the wrong targets. So, you know, don't quote me as being for or against, you know, interrupting AGMs or busting into shareholder meetings. I treat that sort of thing on a case-by-case basis. You know what's not okay? The Guardian is one of the world's largest and most sort of recognized news agencies.
I would say very well respected.
Very well respected, that was actually going to be part of my point. Was that despite the fact that they're I think it's inarguable to say that they're not left leaning, mm-hmm. if you will. They have lefty inclinations. One of the few papers you'll find anywhere, at least in the English speaking world, that actually still maintains an environment section, which is Kevin's old axe to grind. Mm-hmm. And a very, very, very well-populated one, I might add. So they're not exactly right-wing. That being said, they're extremely well-respected. And part of the reason why they get away with what they – or get away with – part of the reason they've been so successful is because, their inclinations aside, they tend to be extremely even-handed and tend not to sort of blow things out of proportion or be hyperbolic. They tend to just be actually good journalists. They tend to do good journalism. And with respect to both directions. So the fact that recently ExxonMobil, and just to remind people, this is the same company that is potentially going to be going to court and has already been hung in the court of public opinion about denying and being actively knowing about climate change, actively knowing that greenhouse gases contribute to climate change, and paying hundreds of millions of dollars for the next 40 years to keep this fact that they knew was true from the public so that they could keep making money, has banned The Guardian from their AGM and accused the newspaper of lacking objectivity on climate change reporting in a campaign against energy companies. Well, you could view it that way. You could also say that you're being litigated against, or at least in the process of being litigated against, for lying for 40 years about this. So it seems a little bit ridiculous, but this story is paired. I mean, and the only thing, there's not really much more to say about it other than the fact that this is now the corner that some of these companies have painted themselves into. And I wanted to take a moment, funnily enough, and this is not where you're expecting me to go with this, but I wanted to take a minute to say here that I think now that we've started to win, it's undeniable that we may have started to win too late. So this isn't any sort of thing like that. We may still be screwed, and the utmost pressure still needs to be kept up.
Yes.
But we did start to get some wins recently, and it looks like the pendulum is sort of at least balancing out. The momentum's coming to a slow, which may not be fast enough again, but still. We've chalked up some wins recently. And I wanted to take this opportunity to say that all major carbon producing industries such as natural resources, so coal and natural gas and all this sort of thing, are not made equally. Some of them are ignorant. Some of them are doing what you would expect any organism to do in an ecosystem, which is protect itself, which I think is the most useful way to speak about corporations on a planet, is that they're an organism trying to breed and be successful. And I find the evolution and ecosystem type metaphor to be extremely useful when talking about economic issues and global markets. And some of them just are straight up evil. Mr. Rex Tillerson is now officially on my list up there with the previously solely CEO of Nestle for worst human beings on the planet. I think that, while I think they haven't done nearly enough, and while I think they've been complicit in lying to the public, and I think that there's 100 million things I could do an entire show on why Suncor is the worst, they are the jewel of my eye compared to Exxon. And I think it's important to take this moment, first of all, that Exxon sucks. Their CEO sucks. They're liars and they're cheaters and they're crooks. And that we need to remember that this is not universally applicable. And that if there was an opportunity to create some sort of alliance with some of the better companies to make some of this stuff happen, I think that's okay, as long as it's not Exxon. So 2 points there. One, Exxon sucks. The fact that they're now banning journalists and that their own shareholders have rejected a bunch of plans that successfully made it to their shareholders meeting, fair enough, is that this is a lost cause. It's a cancer. Get rid of them. They're done. Cut it out. Get rid of it. But in the same breath, that we should not tack this on to all resource companies or all oil companies. Some of them may, in fact, eventually come around and be really big allies in this and become energy companies like we've been asking them to for quite some time. So that's my rant. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Darren. What's funny about that is that does actually – what I love about what you did there was that – I think it helps us tie this whole show together, which again is something that we've been trying to do for a while, largely because Emma, who's currently not in studio but is one of our regular hosts, likes us doing. And so I think
a sense of closure. It's good.
Exactly. It brings us all together. So I want to sort of give Deirdre and Sabina a chance to sort of any last thoughts on the show, and then I'll sort of give my last thoughts on the show, and then we'll throw to the outro music, which I'm sure you all very much enjoy. Outro music, great music. So Sabina, do you got a shot?
Well, I just like to say that I really like the having our guests here today talking about the cap and trade, and I hope to talk a little bit further in the podcast version. So tune in.
Amazing. Deirdre?
Exxon. Man, that thing sucks.
Thank you. Thank you. Solid reporting. Exxon sucks.
Concise.
You can't spell Exxon without two X's.
You have to say hashtag Exxon new.
Yeah.
So to which I've been adding hashtag still does hashtag they suck.
But what I want to get to final thoughts of Exxon all the way back to the very beginning is that I think anyone and Darren pointed out the sort of differentiating between some of the companies that are trying to move towards energy companies versus the oil companies is that if there's gonna be one major shift in the next 20-30 years, I think it's gonna be this final realization from quote unquote business people that climate change is a thing and it has to be taken seriously. And I think if there's any wins at all that we're seeing, it's that slowly but surely you can be a conservative and still accept climate change.
Yeah. I just had a great idea for what we should talk about on the bonus show, Stephen.
All right.
We should talk about whether or not it would be successful in the green movement to say, to pit these companies against each other and say, we're all, as consumers, yes, we're still forced to buy oil to some degree. Many of us still have to drive. We're still largely consumers, even though we want to get away from this economy. What if we took this as an indication and said, guess what? Suncor will make you a deal. And maybe a couple other ones that are sort of like edging in the right direction. We'll make you a deal. For the oil that we do have to buy, we will 100% boycott Exxon. We're going to crash them. You guys get all their market share if you agree to be a little bit more forceful in your transition of your portfolio over to green energy. And then we sink these jerks into the sea. tomorrow.
As long as Sabina also gets to talk about the cap and trade stuff. But I think it's funny about that is that to go back to, again, to call back earlier, what's funny about trying to do that kind of energy boycott to some extent is it's the same reason why Trump saying that he wants the United States to be energy independent is a little bit ludicrous, because oil is a global market. And so the idea that it doesn't matter how much quote unquote energy the United States necessarily makes, you still will be a part of the energy system that's connected. You cannot separate yourself from the world. But we're down to one last minute. So if I think I could give one call out or thought for the day, it's the look, follow this trend, see if this is actually something you believe in, and tweet at us if you have any thoughts on it. But whether or not we are actually seeing a movement of conservatives towards climate change, and whether or not this cap and trade system using the market is the way to sort of get them on side. Because I think the word tax in it, of course, cannot be even uttered by a conservative. And so this idea of a cap and trade trade, which just sounds different, even though it does the exact same thing, is somehow okay because it's the market. And it's this funny little difference, but I think that might be the real answer for getting everyone back on side. And because to some extent, we'll need everybody. It doesn't matter who, which side, we'll need the Trumpites, we'll need literally everybody to solve this crisis. So the sooner we can convince and get our friends, our uncle who may say the wrong things at dinner, but actually to accept climate change, the better off we are. And with that, thank you so much, everybody. This is an Green Majority on CAT 89.5. If you're on the bonus show, we'll be right back. If not, have a great green week. We'll see you all real soon.